This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hey, this is Dick Down here with Joanne Elmers, as mentioned. We're going to be doing the first hour here. We've got some business articles, opinion pieces, and some great news articles, but we're going to start with business. And the headline on the business page is TV shows, movies getting millions from Ohio. Tax credits awarded to 17 film production groups. This is by Cole Behrens of the Columbus Dispatch and the USA Today Network. Artists shooting their movies and television shows in Ohio just got a $44 million in influx in funding from the state. On Tuesday, the Ohio Department of Development announced the latest wave of state support, totaling more than $44 million in tax credits for the filming of TV series and feature films across Ohio, according to a release. Awards are being made through the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit Program, which provides a refundable tax credit of 30% toward production, cast and crew wages, and other in-state spending for eligible productions. The list of eligible productions includes feature-length films, documentaries, pre-Broadway productions, miniseries, video games, and music videos. TV series received tax breaks from Ohio in 2024, and here are the TV shows being funded with tax credits in Ohio this year. An Interesting Life, Season 2, in Southwest Ohio, $432,300 in tax credits. WWE 24 in Ohio, the tax credit is $1,675,986. And Nightmare Transmission Season 2, it's in Ashland and Columbus, $265,247.40. Heartland Horror Chronicles Season 1. In Crestline, the tax credit is $129,444. Christmas on Main in Ashland, $148,842. Kings of Vegas in Cleveland, $105,878.25. And feature films that will receive Ohio tax credits. The Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit Program will provide tax records for more than 15 movie productions in the state this year. They are Genesis in Cleveland and Cincinnati, $11,091,686.70. Super Thief, Northeast Ohio, $5,296,260.30. Alarum, Cincinnati, $5,863,392.30. Epiphany, Cincinnati, $6,052,988.40. And Stained Glass, Southwest Ohio, $3,026,255. The Marshall, Southwest Ohio, $2,380,988.40. And Nutcracker's Mustache, Dayton / Cincinnati, $2,008,106.70. The Last of the Big Time Promoters, that's in Southwest Ohio, $985,500. Never Quit, The Todd Crandall Story, out of Toledo, $1,256,153.40. Harbor Master, Northeast Ohio, $1,113,364.80. And Down to the Felt, in Columbus, $385,853.70. And Oscars Options in Cincinnati, $823,269.60. Slay, Columbus, $519,603.60. The Forgotten Chord, Columbus, $115,651.50. And Heavenly Wickedness from Ashtabula, $110,625. Cannonballer and Summit, $148,371. And Aimless, Columbus, $93,313.50. So here's how the program works. Awarded projects total nearly $503 million in production expenses, $146.7 million in total eligible production expenses, and are expected to create 530 full-time jobs, according to the Ohio Department of Development. Development received 27 applications for the fiscal year of 2024, a January round, requesting nearly $60 million in tax credits. Applications are reviewed and awarded in two rounds each year, and the program provides $50 million annually, evenly divided between the two rounds. There is a $5 million withheld annually from the full amount, specifically for Broadway and theatrical productions. Projects are awarded first to television series or miniseries, then to all others based on the extent of positive economic impact in Ohio and the effect on developing a permanent workforce in motion picture or theatrical productions industries in the state, according to the release. The Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit was created in 2009 to encourage and develop a strong film industry in Ohio. The application and additional programming information can be found at, and this is all lowercase, development.ohio.gov/FILM. Now, if I said that too quickly or you didn't have a paper and pencil handy, give us a call at Radio Services, 513-418-4245. We'll get you the information you need. Joanne?
Proposal to seize patents will harm innovation. That's the headline on the opinion article by Lito Ramirez, who is president and CEO of Down Syndrome Achieves. And here's what he has to say. Approximately one in every 700 babies in the United States is born with Down syndrome. Funding research is crucial to investigating conditions that affect individuals with Down syndrome and developing interventions that significantly improve their quality of life. As a father to a son living with Down syndrome and leader of Down Syndrome Achieves, my work has a dual focus. We support families with loved ones living with Down syndrome, and we facilitate research efforts. DSA supplies researchers with bio samples from our BSA Biobank at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Our research support initiatives are contributing to the development of breakthrough treatments and therapies for individuals living with Down syndrome, ultimately preventing life-threatening medical conditions such as Alzheimer's disease, childhood leukemia, and damaging heart defects. Together with the nation's leading research universities, business groups, and patient advocacy organizations, DSA is concerned with a federal proposal that threatens a key component of our nation's innovative ecosystem. This proposal from the Biden administration intends to use the Buy-Dole Act's march-in provisions to forcibly relicense patents on products that benefited from federal research funding, imperiling public-private sector collaboration. The administration says it will use this legally dubious authority to bring down drug prices, but the proposal applies to all technologies across all industries. So it poses a serious and unnecessary blow to everyone who is hoping for advances in medicines and so much else, from digital technology and clean energy to defense and agricultural technologies. Enacted in 1980, the Bayh-Dole Act enabled universities and other research institutions to keep the patent rights on inventions developed in whole or part with federal funding. This allowed these institutions to license their intellectual property to private firms for further research and development and commercialization. In medicine alone, the system of public-private partnerships enabled by Bayh-Dole has led to the creation of more than 200 new FDA-approved medications. Bayh-Dole is also credited with the creation of a host of other critical technologies and companies, including Google. DSA recently shared our concerns with the Biden administration. In assessing the proposal, our primary concern centers around the potential impact on the R&D ecosystem, particularly in the realm of Down syndrome research. DSA relies on private sector investment, collaboration between public and private entities, and the protection of intellectual property rights to advance our mission. We support making medicines more affordable and accessible. However, we are concerned that the proposed framework for the government's exercise of the Bayh-Dole Act's March In authority will disrupt the system of public-private partnerships that has enabled the development of countless life-enhancing treatments. Our worry is that if the federal government exercises march-in authority on patents, it would become unfeasible for private sector partners to license them and invest the sums necessary to develop federally funded basic research into new treatments. This, in turn, would diminish the return our society currently reaps from the research the government funds. Advances in medical care have significantly increased the life expectancy of individuals with Down syndrome. While it was around 25 years in 1983, life expectancy has now increased to an average of 60 years or more. Breakthroughs in Down syndrome research have contributed to improved educational strategies, early interventions, and medical treatments, enhancing the quality of life for individuals with Down syndrome. Any measures that undermine the incentives for private sector investment in innovative research poses a significant threat to our ability to make progress in understanding and addressing the unique healthcare needs of individuals with Down syndrome. To protect our nation's innovation and discovery capabilities, we hope the Biden administration shelves this proposal. And Lito Ramirez, author of this opinion piece, is president and CEO of Down Syndrome Achieves. And Dick, open the letters.
Well, it's time for the letters, one of the favorite parts of the first hour. And we have three of those letters this morning, which Joanne and I will alternate. And the first one is Cincinnati Mayor Got It Right on Gaza Ceasefire Resolution. I don't often agree with Mayor Aftab Pirival, but he got it right when he decided that the city wouldn't weigh in on the potential of a ceasefire in Gaza. Not only is the issue nuanced, as he stated, but what business does the city of Cincinnati have interfering in a conflict thousands of miles away? There's certainly enough city business to focus on, and in the end, who would care what the city council proclaimed anyway? That's the opinion of Ken Keeler of Sycamore Township.
Homestead exemption cut a double whammy for seniors. In all the articles about the increase in property taxes, there is no mention of the reduction in the homestead exemption allowance. Comparing last year's reduction to this year's reduction, I find that it has been cut in half with no explanation. Researching the Hamilton County Property Database, it is the same with other senior citizens' properties in my area. When was this decided and by whom? Why has this not been made public? That's from Diane Schuler of East Price Hill.
And youth violence needs to be solved by parents. Recently, there has been reported acts of violence by school-age children. The problem needs to be solved by the parents, not the school or the police department. At one time, if a child got into trouble outside of his home, he was in greater trouble at home when the family became aware of his misbehavior. Classes could be required for the parents of children causing problems. These classes need to be mandatory. Maybe some child-rearing classes need to be given before a child gets into serious trouble. And we need to spend our tax dollars where they will do the most good. And that is the opinion of Carol Grayler Law of Kenwood. Joanne?
And now we go to the main news section. And as usual on Fridays, we start with Today in History. Today is February 16. On this date in 1862, the Civil War Battle of Fort Donelson in Tennessee ended as some 12,000 Confederate soldiers surrendered. Union General Ulysses S. Grant's victory earned him the moniker Unconditional Surrender Grant. In 1918, Lithuania proclaimed its independence from the Russian Empire. In 1923, the burial chamber of King Tutankhamun's recently unearthed tomb was unsealed in Egypt by English archaeologist Howard Carter. In 1959, Fidel Castro became premier of Cuba a month and a half after the overthrow of Fulgencio Batista. In 1960, the nuclear-powered radar Pickett submarine USS Triton departed New London, Connecticut on the first submerged circumnavigation by a vessel. In 1961, the United States launched the Explorer 9 satellite. In 1996, 11 people were killed in a fiery collision between an Amtrak passenger train and a Maryland commuter train in Silver Spring, Maryland. In 2011, bookstore chain Borders filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and said it would close nearly a third of its stores. Borders closed all of its remaining stores in September 2011. And the last item, in 2017, in the first full-length news conference of his presidency, Donald Trump denounced what he called the criminal leaks that took down his top national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Dick?
Well, the headlines on page one of the Inquirer today is that, according to the mayor, Gaza resolution would further divide us. There's no consensus for either supporting or opposing a ceasefire, Puravel says. This is by Sharon Coolidge of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Puraval declared Wednesday the city won't be taking a stance on a ceasefire in Gaza, saying such a move would only divide and inflame the city. Puraval's comments came after 4.5 hours of public comment filled with cheers, applause, and occasional boos. Hundreds spoke either for or against a resolution calling for a ceasefire, the second week in a row in which Cincinnati's 9-member council has heard from residents. Consensus language doesn't exist for an issue that is among the most nuanced and complicated in international affairs, said Pierre Rival, who controls the agenda for the 9-member council. Without consensus, it would further divide us and inflame the situation, Pierre Rival said. It's disappointing that I'm sure for many it's frustrating, further dividing our beloved community. He encouraged dialogue. For Pierreval, who is of Tahitian descent, the issue is intensely personal, he said. It has deeply affected my own family, Pierreval said. Just a couple of generations ago, my family was forced to run from their own homes. Tahitians, he added, have never stopped running. When council stands on a ceasefire, while many of the 9 council members spoke on the issue last week, none did Wednesday night. Council members Reggie Harris, Mark Jeffries, and Seth Walsh signed a joint statement last week. That statement read in part, after several weeks of conversations with different stakeholders in the Cincinnati area, we do not believe that we as Cincinnati City Council can put forward a balanced and unifying resolution on the war in Gaza. Instead, we are asking representatives from both communities impacted by the conflict to discuss a path forward where both communities can have their voices heard. On October 7th, Hamas launched a series of attacks in Israel, firing thousands of rockets and storming communities near the Gaza Strip. At least 1,200 Israelis were killed and hundreds more were kidnapped. Israel has responded by invading and bombing the densely populated Palestinian enclave, killing tens of thousands of civilians. For weeks, citizens have been coming to public comment asking the all-democratic city council to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire. The resolution is ceremonial only, since Cincinnati's council has no say in the war. But to those urging the resolution, it would have meant they had been heard, was the message they shared. Pierreval assured those in attendance that he and council members were listening. On February 7th, Councilwoman Mika Owens agreed with the group and said council members should not stay silent. Council debated the idea but took no action at that meeting. There was no resolution on this week's agenda either, but last week served as a call to action for the others. The speakers Wednesday represented the Jewish Federation and Jewish Community Relations Council, with speakers seeking all members of council to sign Harris, Jeffries, and Walsh's statement. Others echoed former Cincinnati First Lady Dina Cranley, who brought forward the idea of a resolution and support for Palestinians. And then there were speakers from the Cincinnati chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, who also were those who pushed council to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Joanne?
Colorado Attorney General sues to stop Kroger takeover. Antitrust cases could derail Albertson's merger. This is by Alexander Coolidge of the Enquirer. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser announced Wednesday his office was suing to stop the proposed $25 billion Kroger takeover of rival Albertsons and accused the two chains of having, quote, blatantly violated antitrust law, end quote. Weiser said the merger would eliminate head-to-head competition between Kroger and Albertsons, which he claimed would harm consumers, workers, and suppliers. He noted Kroger operates 148 stores, parentheses, under the King, Supers, and City Market banners, close parens, in the state, and Albertsons runs 105 stores, parentheses, under its namesake and Safeway banners, close parens. He noted the deal would create significant market power to raise prices in urban areas like Denver. He added the deal would also deeply affect smaller markets like Gunnison's that has only 2 supermarkets operated by the merging rivals. The lawsuit is the second antitrust case filed by a state to block the deal. Washington State filed its own case on January 15. There's also a pending consumer lawsuit also seeking to halt the deal in federal court in California. The legal actions come as federal regulators at the Federal Trade Commission are deciding whether to challenge the merger. The case is also the second one filed in a state court through attorneys general, though attorneys general have the ability to file antitrust actions in federal court. Antitrust experts note that while U.S. regulators may sue to halt the merger in federal court, the state cases are separate legal threats that also have the potential to kill the deal. Quote, Congress intentionally designed U.S. antitrust laws to provide standing to different types of parties. This means federal, state, and consumers all have equal authority to challenge a merger. Christine Bartholomew, a law professor at the University of Buffalo, told the Inquirer, I suspect there may be others in the near future. Kroger said in a statement it is working with multiple attorneys general and the FTC to address their antitrust concerns. We are disappointed in Attorney General Weiser's premature decision to file a lawsuit while the merger is still under regulatory review, the company said, adding it would vigorously defend the deal in court. Claims of a secret illegal deal during strike. The antitrust lawsuit filed in the state's Denver District Court came after Weiser's office investigated the deal's potential impact for a year and held several public forums with consumers. Weiser, in a statement, said Coloradans are concerned about undue consolidation and its harmful impacts on consumers, workers, and suppliers. After 19 town halls across the state, I am convinced that Coloradans think this merger between the two supermarket chains would lead to stores closing, higher prices, fewer jobs, worse customer service, and less resilient supply chains, end quote. Weiser's investigation into the deal also uncovered what he claimed was an illegal deal struck between two rivals during a 10-day strike at Kroger's King Soopers stores in 2022. Kroger, which was worried about losing workers and customers to Albertsons, persuaded its rival not to hire Kroger workers or solicit its pharmacy customers, according to an email between grocery executives prior to the strike. Such deals are illegal under Colorado law because the companies were agreeing not to compete. Weiser said, besides blocking the deal, Colorado is seeking $1 million in civil penalties for the non-compete deal. Weiser said, in addition to challenging this merger, we are also suing the two companies for a no-poach agreement that harmed workers and blatantly violated antitrust law. Kroger's statement did not address the allegation. A Democrat, Weiser has been the attorney general since 2019. He was reelected last fall. Weiser's office also lambasted the $1.9 billion divestiture deal of more than 400 stores to C&S Wholesale Grocers meant to allay antitrust concerns about competition. Weiser said C&S has insufficient retail grocery experience to take on a divestiture of this size, Weiser said, noting it owns only 23 grocery stores and none in Colorado. He added that once the merger and divestiture were complete, CNS would be a smaller competitor with Kroger than Albertsons is now. Dick?
Well, we got the local buzz here. Always a I know it's one of Joanne's favorites and mine too. And for this week, we have a woman who says, I tried a cherry thingling and admit they are amazing. A few years ago, when I turned 50, I made a promise to myself to never wait in line for food again. I'd wasted too many hours standing in line for the world-famous pizzas at Sally's in New Haven, Connecticut. I'd endured two-hour waits for smash burgers when Danny Myers opened his first Shake Shack location in Manhattan. I'd even waited an hour and a half in line at New York's flagship Godiva location to buy a box of chocolates for my wife on Valentine's Day. That's why I was thankful that Inquirer reporter Grace Tucker made the 45-mile trip to Schmidt's Bakery in Batesville, Indiana, to pick up a dozen cherry thingelings for the office this year. Lucky for us, since people are known to wait in line for over 3 hours to get them. Thankfully, Grace didn't have to do that. The good people at Schmidt, the only bakery that makes them, had an early batch waiting for her when she arrived. And thingelings, for the uninitiated, are cherry fritters that are only sold around the time of President's Day. They're meant to honor President George Washington and that tall tale we've all heard about him cutting down the cherry tree and copping to it afterwards. The thingeling was introduced in the early 70s by Schmidt founder Clem Schmidt. For years, they were only available on the Sunday before President's Day, but due to demand, they're now sold from the Thursday before President's Day through Monday, and in 2024, that means February 15 through 19. Like young Georgie boy, I cannot tell a lie. As popular as thingelings are, I'd never tried one before, and I didn't have a desire to. That's because I largely don't eat donuts and fritters, which I find cloyingly sweet and instantly regrettable. I do have a list of exceptions. Apple cider donuts are scrumptious in the fall. Chocolate-covered donuts from Dunkin' take me back to my childhood. And some of the gourmet donuts from Starlight Donut Lab in Norwood are just too tempting to pass up. After trying my first craggy and colorful little thingling, I'd have to add it to my list of exceptions, too. On first bite, the fried donut taste prevails, but something magical happens when it surrenders to a burst of fresh sour cherries that are folded into the dough as well as the icing. Warmed up in the office microwave, they taste like something a loving grandmother would make for the grandkids as a special birthday treat. They are, quite simply, remarkable. Would I wait 3 hours in line for them? Not in your life, but at least I get why people do. And that's the contribution of Keith Pandolfi. And this is all edited by Liz Dufour of the Inquirer. Joanne?
Body cam shows police talking to Marie Montine. This is by Cameron Knight of the Inquirer. Body camera footage released by the Fairfax Police Department shows a conversation between officers and a teen accused of making a hit list and planning to attack his high school. The 14-year-old Mariemont High School freshman is charged with conspiracy to commit aggravated murder, a rare charge for those who make school threats. He was arrested at Mariemont High School on the same day the encounter with officers took place. Hamilton County Prosecutor Melissa Powers released texts between the teen and an adult in Colorado that discussed killing students and gassing the school at a press conference February 8th, and said evidence shows the attack was imminent. Police said the teen admitted to making the plan in an interview that took place with the teen's father present. Powers wants to try the teen as an adult, which would put life in prison on the table as a possible penalty. In another rare move, Hamilton County's Public Defender's Office issued a statement saying the teen was on the autism spectrum and had other mental challenges, and that trying him as an adult would be against everyone's interest and not help public safety. Despite the multiple statements and a press conference, there are still more questions that have not been answered, including what is happening to the man in Colorado? Why was the student communicating with the Colorado man? What made prosecutors believe that the threat would be carried out? How will the teen's diagnosis be considered? What's in the body camera footage? Two police officers met with the father of the teen on his front step just before 8 a.m. on February 7. The father said he had heard rumors about a threat to the school the previous day. He told the officers his son had been complaining about another student who was bullying him and others, and that his advice was, stay away from that kid. The officer said an anonymous report was made saying the teen was going to get some gun and go shoot up the school. The father said his son often does not know how to interpret conversations with other students. The man said he misses social cues in conversation. Irony flies over his head. The teen walked out with his backpack, and the police offered him the same advice as his father, to stay away from the other student causing problems and to talk to the school officials if he has any issues. The teen recounted a conversation with another student in the library. The teen said he had an OnlyFans. He said something about doing a school shooting with some dude in Chicago. The teen's father told his son that this is how quickly rumors are shared. There was a conversation in a library, and 12 hours later, the police were at their door. The officer said that the officials at the school were going to talk to the teen and send him and his father on their way to school. During the conversation, the father admitted that he had a gun in the house and asked if he should remove it from the home until things settled down. One of the officers said that sounded like a good idea. The father asked the officers if they would hold it for him, and they agreed. The inquirer asked the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office about the severity of the charge the teen is facing. It is common for those who make school threats to be charged with inducing panic or aggravated menacing. Hamilton County juvenile court officials reported that their records show this is the only time since the charge has been used since the beginning of 2020. The prosecutor's office issued the following statement. We are working with law enforcement as the investigation in this matter continues. While limited evidence has been released to the public for the purpose of conveying the seriousness of the situation, it does not represent the full extent of evidence we anticipate presenting to the court in this case. To preserve the integrity of the investigation and forthcoming litigation, we do not have any further comment we can offer at this time. Investigation into the Colorado man is ongoing. Media outlets have reported that the FBI is investigating the man in Colorado who was communicating with the teen, but no charges have come at the federal level. However, Mariemont Police Chief Rick Hines said the investigation into that man is still occurring at the local level. If it is determined the man has committed a crime, he could be charged at the county level, either in Hamilton County or another county where he was communicating with the teen. The public defender's office said the teen was a victim of this man's predatory behavior. What's next? The teen remains detained at the Hamilton County Youth Center pending his next hearing February 21 in juvenile court. In order to transfer the case to adult court, prosecutors need to file motions for a bindover hearing. If a juvenile is charged with certain serious offenses, such as murder, and if the juvenile is 16, bindover can be mandatory. In this case, the juvenile court judge will decide if the teen should be sent to adult court. Dick?
Well, snow is in the forecast again. This is by Hadiza Ogude of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. Snow passed greater Cincinnati on Valentine's Day, but the chance for winter precipitation may return this weekend. According to a hazardous weather outlook from the National Weather Service in Wilmington, light snow accumulations may occur Friday afternoon into Friday night in Hamilton, Claremont, Butler, and Warren counties in Ohio, and Boone, Kenton, and Campbell counties in Kentucky. The precipitation type looks to be mainly snow with a mix of rain and snow south of the Ohio River, with accumulation amount of an inch or less. The highest totals of around an inch are expected across eastern Indiana and into southwest Ohio. Snow was in the forecast for Tuesday and Wednesday, but missed the region. If it does snow Friday, impacts on the morning commute will likely be limited due to ground and air temperatures. High temperatures will range from the lower 30s in northwest to the lower 40s in the southeast. Some lingering snow showers may continue to move through the region Saturday, and Saturday also looks to be one of the coldest days of the weekend, with high temperatures reaching only the upper 20s and low 30s. Temperature will rise to the low 40s on Sunday. And a detailed Cincinnati weather forecast, Friday. Snow, mainly after 3 p.m., high near 42 degrees. Northeast winds 3 to 7 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation is 80%. New snow accumulation of less than a half an inch is possible. And snow likely mainly before 8 p.m. Cloudy during the early evening, then gradual clearing with a low around 23. North wind 6 to 10 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation is 70%. New snow accumulation is less than a half inch is possible. And then Saturday, sunny with a high near 33. Northwest wind 7 to 13 miles an hour. Mostly clear at night with a low around 22. And Sunday, sunny with a high near 45. Monday, which is also President's Day, sunny with a high near 52. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 55. And the source, the National Weather Service in Wilmington, Ohio. Joanne?
Bomb threats target three northern Kentucky schools in less than 24 hours. This is by Quinlan Bentley of the Inquirer. Bomb threats on Thursday resulted in lockdowns at two northern Kentucky schools less than 24 hours after a hoax bomb threat was made to Boone County High School. The first threat came just after 8 a.m. when deputies were notified of a bomb threat directed at Connor High School in Hebron, the Boone County Sheriff's Office said in a news release. Officers said the information was provided by a third party through a suicide prevention hotline, and the person making the threat said they weren't present at the school building. The statements and details surrounding the threat suggested to authorities that the suspect did not have intimate knowledge about the school, according to the sheriff's office. Deputies did not find any active threat when they responded to the high school, and the lockdown has since been lifted, said Sergeant Anthony Thietge. The investigation is ongoing, and deputies have yet to identify a suspect. Beechwood evacuated building Thursday morning. Around 11.05 a.m., the Beechwood Independent Schools campus in Fort Mitchell was evacuated of students and staff after Kenton County dispatchers received a bomb threat similar to the calls made in Boone County, the school district said in a letter to parents. Fort Mitchell police and fire personnel responded to the school to perform a sweep of the campus. Boone County schools locked down Wednesday. On Wednesday afternoon, Boone County High School in Florence was placed on temporary lockdown after a threat was made about a bomb being placed on school grounds. A Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport police bomb unit searched the premises and no explosives devices were found. Dick?
Well, according to police, skeletal remains in Fairmont not connected to dismemberment. This is by Quinlan Bentley of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. More human remains were found in North Fairmont on Wednesday, but they are not thought to be connected to the dismembered remains of a woman found in the neighborhood in November, Cincinnati police were said. The skeletal remains were found in the 1700 block of Fairmont Avenue, less than a mile away from Baltimore Avenue, where police located the remains of a woman officially have begun labeling Fairmont Jane Doe. Police said the newer set of remains is believed to be associated with a person who went missing in April of 2022, adding there's no evidence to suggest a connection with the earlier dismemberment case. The Cincinnati Police Department and Hamilton County's Coroner's Office are investigating the death. Officials have yet to release the circumstances of death regarding the remains found Wednesday. Investigators still work to identify Jane Doe, found in November. The investigators are still working to identify Fairmont Jane Doe, who was the victim of a homicide. She was likely killed around November 3rd and placed in the woods shortly after. She is black, 20 to 45 years old, between 5 feet and 5 foot 5 inches tall, with an athletic build. She had no tattoos or identifying marks on her body, though police say she is a mother. After finding the woman's torso in November, another search was conducted on January 3rd and a head was located several streets away. Coroner Lakshmi Samarko said DNA was used to match the head to the torso, confirming they belong to the same woman. Samarko said evidence shows the body was purposely dismembered and investigators have determined a likely cause of death, but that information has not been released. The FBI has been investigating if there are any associations between this killing and others, according to the police, but so far, officials have not said if any other connections have been made. Rumors of a serial killer proved untrue, officials said. And investigators have also been looking into whether the woman hailed from outside the Cincinnati area. And anyone with information can call Crime Stoppers at 513-352-3040. Again, 513-352-3040. If I said that too quickly or if you didn't have a pencil paper handy, give us a call at Radio Reading Services, 513-487-4245. We'll get you the information that you need. Joanne?
One dead, one wounded in shooting near Xavier campus. This is by Aaron Couch of the Inquirer. A man is dead and another person wounded after a shooting Monday night in Evanston. First responders went to the 3500 block of Idlewood Avenue at 9:45 p.m. for a shooting, according to a news release from Cincinnati Police. There, they found D'Amico Nelson, 25, suffering from a gunshot wound. He died shortly after arriving at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. Another person was shot and taken to the hospital. That victim's injuries are not considered life-threatening. The shooting took place about a block. Lost it. A block from the Dana Avenue side of Xavier University's campus. The latest Cincinnati crime data available shows incidents through February 6. There were 18 shooting incidents with 22 victims since the beginning of 2024 and that date. There have been several shootings in the past 8 days, including downtown on Sunday and in the West End February 7. From the beginning of 2023 to February 6, 2023, there were 29 shootings in Cincinnati. Anyone with information about the Evanston shooting is asked to call homicide investigators at 513-352-3542. I'll repeat that. 513-352-3542. Dick?
Bomb threats target 3 Northern Kentucky schools in less than 24 hours.
I read that.
Oh, you did? Okay, I'm sorry. Let's go across here then. Gun danger lurks wherever people gather. Prevalence of firearms worsen risks of attacks is by Elizabeth Weiss, the USA Today. A Super Bowl victory parade in Kansas City, Missouri became another joyful celebration marred by gun violence, reminding us, if we ever forget, that a lurking danger hovers over Americans every time we gather together to celebrate, honor, and commemorate. The chance that a single event might become the scene of violence is relatively small, but tragedy after tragedy has become a part of the national psyche. Some politicians and advocates are again questioning where in America it is truly safe to assemble. This shooting is yet another reminder that no parade, no church, no school, really nowhere at all, is safe from America's gun violence crisis, John Feinblatt, president of Every Town for Gun Safety, said after Wednesday's shooting in Kansas City, Missouri. In 2017, a gunman shot more than 11,000 rounds of ammunition at an outdoor country music concert near his Las Vegas hotel as fans crouched in terror. 60 people died. In 2022, a man with a rifle fired into a 4th of July parade outside Chicago. Parents frantically ran, some holding their children. 7 died. And now, 11 children were shot in the moments after a Super Bowl victory parade Wednesday. Thousands of red-clad fans ran for their lives across confetti-strewn streets. In total, 22 people suffered gunshot wounds, including one fatality, interim Kansas City Chief Ross Grundyson said. Kevin Sanders, 53, of Lenexa, Kansas, summed it up simply, "It sucks that someone had to ruin the celebration," he said after hearing the gunshots in the crowd. And last year, the U.S. experienced 10 fatal public mass shootings that killed 72 people, according to USA Today's Mass Killing Database, a partnership with Associated Press and Northeastern University. That's the most in a year since tracking began in 2006. I think that's something that all of us who are parents, who are just regular people living each day, have to decide what we wish to do about, said Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas, who attended the parade with his wife and mother and had to run for cover when gunfire broke out. Parades, rallies, schools, movies, it seems like almost nothing is safe, he said. This resonates deeply in a nation that has a long tradition of gathering and celebrating together. And what are we waiting for? In Kansas City, more than 800 law enforcement officers were on hand to provide security along the parade route, said Police Chief Stacy Graves. But in a nation awash in guns, it's hard for law enforcement to prevent such attacks. Some leaders and activists say that it means the nation needs stricter gun laws in general. Lucas has joined with mayors across the country in calling for new laws to reduce gun violence, including mandating universal background checks for gun buyers. Moms Demand Action Executive Director Angela Farrell Zavala said the shooting should promote politicians to tighten gun laws, should prompt politicians to tighten gun laws. A Super Bowl victory parade that should have been pure joy became a tragedy for a community, she said. American attitudes toward gun violence seems to be shifting slightly, 6 in 10 adults last year said gun violence was a very big problem in the country, up 9 percentage points from 2022, according to the Pew Research Center. And almost 2 in 3 said they expect the level of gun violence to increase over the next 5 years. The Super Bowl, watched this year by more than 1 in 3 Americans, is the most unifying event in America, President Joe Biden said late Wednesday. Nothing brings more of us together, Biden said, and the celebration of a Super Bowl win is a moment that brings joy that can't be matched to the winning team and their supporters. For this joy to be turned to tragedy today in Kansas City cuts deep in the American soul. Biden called for a ban on assault weapons, limits on high-capacity magazines, and strengthened background checks. Today's event should move us, shock us, shame us into acting, he said. What are we waiting for? What else do we need to see? And worries in an earlier time. When the San Francisco 49ers won the Super Bowl in 1982, the city threw a disastrous parade, in part because officials had planned for 25,000 people to attend. Instead, 500,000 showed. It was a case of civic negligence, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote, because police moved part of the parade route to accommodate the crowd, meaning many who had lined up for hours never got to see their team go by. It was the worst parade I never saw, 49ers fan John Sheridan told the paper. And today, officials must speak to more painful issues. I appreciate the bravery and coordination of the law enforcement officers, first responders, and healthcare workers for ensuring a swift, orderly evacuation and caring for the victims, Representative Sharice Davids, a Democrat from Kansas, wrote on X. The traumatic memories of today will stick with children, families, and community members for far too long, she posted. This does not reflect the spirit of Kansas City, and I support those asking for a chance to ensure a brighter and safer safer future. Joanne?
Administration floats new student debt relief formula. This is by Zachary Shermerly of USA Today. The Biden administration is proposing an ambitious new way to determine which low-income Americans could qualify for student debt relief. Under the plan rolled out by the Education Department on Thursday, the federal government would consider the life challenges that prevent certain borrowers from making progress on their loans when assessing if a person is eligible for student loan forgiveness. Whether a borrower has a disability or other high-cost burdens for essential expenses such as costs related to health care or caring for a loved one would become bigger factors in the agency's thinking. Household income, the person's assets, and their age would be considered as well. And that's all the time we have for today. This is Joanne Albers wishing you a happy weekend.
And this is Dick Dowd telling you to bundle up because it's going to be cold outside.
Stay safe.